Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Meet Gary. Gary's about to become an Einstein in an instant.
Whoa, Einstein hair. I like it.
That's right, Gary, because you're using Salesforce powered by Einstein AI to connect data, predict business trends, generate personalized content, and wow customers.
I do feel a lot smarter.
Because you're not just Gary anymore. You're Gary, empowered by Einstein AI.
Did you hear that, team? I'm an Einstein.
Oh, can I get a selfie?
The number one AI CRM. Now everyone's an Einstein with Salesforce.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
We absolutely support Israel's right to defend itself in line with international law.
We need to safeguard financial stability.
2024 is not going to be an easy year.
We used to call it the dream of home ownership, but look at Britain now.
We've got to hang on to optimism and hope because it is the biggest driver of change.
Let's stop thinking of life in terms of Brexit. Let's move on and look to the future.
Hello, you're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Caroline Hepke.
And I'm Lizzie Burden.
So we've got a difficult programme to talk about the UK in recession and the threat of war. And so I thought I'd better start with something a bit lighter. Love, it's meant to make the world go round. We've just had Valentine's Day. Did you have a good day, Lizzie?
I did on my own.
Oh, all right. So look, couples out there might be feeling loved up, but there is one relationship that may be a bit more on the rocks. The so-called special relationship between the US and UK. The Foreign Secretary, David Cameron, has found himself in hot water with the US representative Marjorie Taylor Greene for urging the US Congress to approve an aid package for Ukraine. Now, her choice of words in response to his pressure was quite interesting. Have a listen.
I think he tried to compare us to Hitler also. And if that's the kind of language he wants to use, I really have nothing to say to him.
Well, he likened you to an appeaser to Hitler in not voting through funding for Ukraine.
David Cameron needs to worry about his own country, and frankly, he can kiss my ass.
But do you think Putin's the good guy in all this?
So, a door slam there at the end of response from the US Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, speaking about David Cameron's attempts to persuade US lawmakers to approve aid for Ukraine. So he was trying to underline the seriousness of it. He was also writing an opinion piece for the American publication The Hill.
It makes you wonder whether a Trump presidency in which people like her could play a pivotal role would actually shut the door on the special relationship between the UK and the US. Trump's already making his feelings on foreign policy very clear. We're going to talk more later on the programme about the presidential candidate's plans for a NATO makeover. But you have to wonder as well what a second presidency would mean for the transatlantic relationship.
Well, even the special relationship, which was at its height, really, under Donald Trump, his visit to the UK when the Queen was still alive and with Boris Johnson, even that did have moments of quite significant tension. So is it going to get any easier?
And there was no trade deal, even when it was Bojo and Trump in the White House. But let's get back to the economics, shall we? You've read the headline, the UK is officially in recession. GDP fell more than expected in the fourth quarter of 2023, so it's the second straight quarter of contraction. But is this more than a technicality? Well, earlier, Hannah Slaughter, who's a senior economist at the think tank The Resolution Foundation, joined Stephen Carroll. Here's her take.
I mean, it's definitely big news that, you know, the UK is in a technical recession. So we've seen two quarters now of negative growth. The data out today, you know, gave us new data for quarter four and you know, showed that the data for quarter three wasn't revised. I mean, I do think it's worth looking at the big picture here. I mean, you know, first thing to say is that that we've seen negative growth, but it is, you know, relatively kind of small numbers, you know, 0.1 and 0.3. There is a chance that the, especially the later data period could be revised as well in future. But, you know, it's definitely not good news for the economy, but I think it kind of fits into the wider picture, which has been one of stagnation. And, you know, whether today's figure had been just above zero, just below zero, that kind of, that big picture wouldn't have changed. It's still, you know, whether or not we're in recession, we're still very much a nation of economic stagnation. And that's been a long-term challenge that we've been facing.
So that was the Resolution Foundation's Hannah Slaughter. For more analysis, we're joined by our very own Anna Andrade, our Europe economist here at Bloomberg Economics. Anna, let's ask you the same question. Obviously, recession makes for a toxic headline. I know that some of the newspapers have actually not even used the word. How much does it matter, though, to economists?
I would have said that it wouldn't matter if GDP had actually came in line with our expectations. So if it had contracted by 0.1% on the quarter. But after seeing today's data, not only the scale of the contraction in the last quarter, which was 0.3, but also more details in the data, I think we can use that word recession a bit more comfortably. Now, it's obviously, in historical terms, an incredibly mild recession, but it's a recession nonetheless. And you can see that because if you look at the market sector output, for instance, that excludes government activity, it's been contracting for the last three quarters. Household consumption has fallen 1% in the second half of last year, and the GDP per head has been essentially falling since the middle of 2022. So overall, you know, it is what we saw was sort of recession, but I would agree with Anna's assessment that, you know, it won't feel that differently to the kind of broad state of stagnation that the UK has been in the past 1 year and a half.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I was going to ask you whether people will feel it or whether, you know, it's sort of stagnation, therefore business as normal.
Yeah, I think it will feel like pretty much the same. I mean, at the beginning, or let's say from the middle of 2022, you had households sort of feeling the heat from high inflation. Now what we're seeing, now that kind of has moderated a bit because inflation has come down, real incomes have sort of started to recover. And now what you're seeing is kind of a different hit. So sort of maybe the hit from interest rates. But I think a big important factor and the reason why, you know, I think we've been kind of not panicking about the word recession too much and why people might not be feeling it as much as they would typically feel a normal recession is really the labor market. Because of all the labor shortages that we've had following the pandemic, a lot of businesses decided to hoard onto labor because of fears of rehiring. They thought they would struggle to rehire again. So that definitely contributed to, you know, some strength, some resilience, and contributed to the fact that a lot of people haven't actually felt kind of the pain and the hit from unemployment.
Yeah, if you look at the numbers, you've got 900,000 vacancies, a two-year high in consumer confidence. Historically, how would this recession compare? Is this one actually unique?
Yeah, I think on your point about vacancies, I think what's really important to say is that, yeah, vacancies are historically high, and that seems a bit odd with the fact that we're getting a recession. But if you look at how much they've fallen, so they peak, I think, at 1.3 million in the middle of 2022. So, you know, they have kind of, there was a lot of labor demand that was destroyed because of monetary policy. So in a way, that's part of the weakness. And that's how you fit kind of this elevated number of vacancies with the weakness that you've been seeing in GDP.
Yesterday, also, we heard from the Bank of England Governor Andrew Bailey, sort of still concerned about persistent wage growth in the UK, even though we had inflation data out this week. Do you think that this is going to be a significant concern in terms of weaker UK growth? Does that mean that we get interest rate cuts sooner rather than later in the UK?
Yeah, I mean, that point about wage growth, I also heard it. And I mean, I do think that the wage growth was the data point of all of these data releases that we had over the past year that did surprise a bit. But what I saw as well was Andrew Bailey being kind of very comfortable with that upside surprise in the sense that he said it was an upside surprise, but actually what you need to look at is the fall, and it's that it's been falling. And out of all the data releases that we had this week, I think the most important one was inflation. That kind of came a little bit below the BOE, both the headline and services. And then we had, and that's So just to be clear, that's what's going to, you know, move the Bank of England and dictate the easing cycle of the Bank of England. But we think that this kind of undershoot on the GDP numbers that we got today, of course, they won't rush the BOE into acting exactly because of what I said, because they're laser focused on inflation, and that will only fall below 2% in the spring. So that doesn't mean that we're going to get a cut in March. But I think it will kind of leave the policymakers concerned enough to kind of cut at the earliest possible window, which we think is May. So essentially, the data that we've got this week on balance still leaves our call that rate cuts will come in May still in play.
Yeah, and for many of our audience, notably, the UK inflation print looked actually better because of the nasty shock that you got out of the US the day before. Just going back to the GDP, though, Anna, why were economists caught off guard? Which parts of the economy were actually weaker than forecast?
I think there was two things. Number one was there were revisions to it. So, I mean, for instance, this private consumption, this household consumption, the fall in household consumption that you got in the third quarter had been kind of 0.5, I think, and it kind of nearly doubled to 0.9%. So in a way, it was revisions in terms of one explaining the broad weakness of the second half of last year. But I think overall, it was just kind of monetary policy having a bit more impact than we had been kind of got used to this picture of, you know, an incredibly resilient economy. And it turned out that actually, you know, the economy was performing a little bit worse. And I think it was just broad based. There was nothing particular that, you know, caught us off guard.
Mm. The data, though, that we're talking about in terms of economic growth is backward looking. And economists are always far more focused on what the data is going to be able to tell us about the future. So are business people. Do you think that the economy might recover this year? What's the kind of outlook now for the UK?
Yeah, so that's definitely the good news coming. So we've had this kind of hit from monetary policy, but it does look like the worst is over. In our forecast, we still have a little bit of weakness at the start of the quarter. But then what we think we'll see is kind of GDP growth gaining pace and picking up to 0.2% and growing at that rate for the remainder of the year. Now, that sort of pace of expansion is not spectacular, but it will mark a difference from this kind of broad state of stagnation that we've been getting. And essentially, it will be driven by, you know, a significant fall in energy prices, utility bills are going to fall by around 15% in April. They can fall again in July. It will be driven as well by easier funding conditions, because even though the BOE hasn't started cutting rates, the market curve has sort of moved, and that's what matters for the pricing of financial products and loans. And at the same time, real incomes will continue to recover as inflation falls further. So overall, it's looking brighter further ahead.
Okay, on a big week for UK economic data, glad we could get you on. Anna Andrade, our Europe economist, thank you.
There is perhaps, though, a bigger worry even than sluggish economies here in the UK and in Europe, and that is the threat of conflict, Lizzie. If that seemed like a distant possibility in the 20 years after the Cold War era, it certainly isn't now. Amid wars in Ukraine and the Middle East and the seemingly intractable tensions with Beijing, NATO defence ministers are meeting in Brussels. And so you've got on one side Putin. Western intelligence assessments suggest that the Kremlin could be in a position to target a NATO member country within perhaps 3 to 5 years. And on the other side, you've got Donald Trump, his comments about letting Russia attack members of NATO. And Bloomberg's latest reporting from people familiar with the matter suggests that Trump is considering scaled back commitments to some NATO members were he to win a second term in the White House. Joining us now to discuss this is Ed Arnold, who is a research fellow for European security from the defence and security think tank, the Royal United Services Institute, otherwise known as RUSI. Ed, welcome to the programme. For, you know, a really pretty troubling conversation, Jens Stoltenberg, the NATO Secretary General, has warned against a path that divides Europe and North America. So really reacting, it would seem, to Trump's comments. How much do you think Donald Trump, his candidacy, is going to overshadow this NATO meeting that's taking place today?
Yeah, well, I think it will probably overshadow the Defence Minister's meeting today. But equally, you've got to remember that it's NATO's 75th birthday this year as well. So the anniversary of the signing of the Washington Treaty in early April. And then also its annual summit is in Washington in the summer, right in the middle of the US presidential election. So I think the comments that Trump came out with recently will dominate. And equally, what we saw with those comments, I mean, the first part of it was to, complain about European freeloading and not spending as much on defense as he thinks that they should, which is a perfectly legitimate argument to have. It was the second part of it where he said that he would maybe encourage Russia to sort of do whatever they want to those laggards. So it's really the escalation in the comments that I think we need to be really worried about.
Does this idea of a two-tiered NATO have any legs, Ed? Are there anyone, any other members that think, that could be a decent idea?
Not really, because I mean, the North Atlantic Treaty's 14 articles. Everyone talks about Article 5 because it's the ultimate security guarantee. And it's the ultimate security guarantee because everyone buys into it, and it really sort of brings US power into the continent. So having a two-tier NATO doesn't really work because you absolutely want that requirement. And actually, the way that NATO is structured at the moment, I mean, first from sort of 2016 in response to Russian aggression in Crimea, the European, well, NATO created these European battle groups. So there were four, and they were extended to eight after the invasion in 2022. And that actually pulls Americans and other sort of nations into the frontline states. So actually, you'd be targeted in any war with Russia by virtue of the fact that you have troops deployed there. And that's why a lot of, independently from NATO, a lot of frontline states in from NATO also have bilaterals with the US because they want to pull US personnel into their own countries so that if their countries are attacked, US military takes casualties, and then that pursues the US response. So any paring back of the US and then withdrawing from those frontline states is obviously going to be a real concern for them.
Stoltenberg also talked about in the very brief opening remarks for this NATO gathering about the defence industrial capacity that Europe has, about talking about increasing it and working on its capacity, and also about the unprecedented increase in defence spending across European allies and in Canada, as he put it. I wonder what your assessment is of how war ready, how much capacity there is in Europe, and how quickly it's being built up now.
I think it's not being built up as quickly as it needed to. I think you're especially on the European side. I mean, the US is slightly different just because of the scale and, being the world's greatest defense spender. But on the European side, I mean, in the UK military, it was assessed that we probably only had enough ammunition, artillery ammunition to fight for maybe a week, two max. In Germany, it was assessed at around 2 days. So all of these things are being addressed, but I think they're being addressed quite slowly, considering the threat and the fact that we are politically supporting Ukraine and therefore militarily supporting Ukraine also to take back their territory. But they need a lot of ammunition to do that. They're already having to ration ammunition on the 1,000 kilometer front line this year because of where the US and also the EU funding has been blocked and delayed for a considerable amount of time. And the issue, again, which is worrying in Trump's comments, is that Trump stops providing support to Ukraine. He can still provide support to Europe through NATO or other means. But it means Europeans then need to pick up that slack and also restock their own munitions cupboards, which is
So
going to
if
be a
you
real challenge.
take that to its conclusion, is it as simple as if Trump gets in, Zelensky's going to have to negotiate a peace deal and it's game over for Ukraine?
It's not quite as simple as that, but I mean, it will put a lot more pressure on unless the Europeans can sort of effectively take up the slack. The problem on the European side is it's not just about sort of, you know, this isn't just a financial commitment, although that is obviously a really important part of it. It's also one of political will. And if you remember when the US wanted to pull out from Afghanistan and sort of end the NATO mission, there was a discussion between NATO members of saying, well, couldn't we do this without the Americans? And at the time, that was assessed as a relatively small mission of around 2,500 troops. And the agreement wasn't made, and the assessment made was that NATO can't do that without the US. So can the Europeans keep supporting Ukraine without the Americans? Doesn't look likely. And also, can the Europeans defend Europe without the Americans? Again, doesn't really look likely. But on the latter, the Europeans have no choice, because it's going to be their battleground in any future war with Russia.
Wow, that is certainly food for thought. Bloomberg reports that also Trump advisors have been discussing, I mean, on the Ukraine point, getting Volodymyr Zelensky and also Vladimir Putin around a negotiating table. So that's sort of our reporting about what might be being discussed by Trump advisors. So I think that's quite fascinating. What's your view then on what Trump's words and actions around NATO mean for allies in Asia, about whether the US would defend them against any possibility of a conflict with China? Because that's, you know, that's the other potential theatre of war.
Yes, it is. And I think while Trump's ire has been focused on NATO because, you know, to make his here, you know, his narrative that the Europeans don't spend enough, it's quite easy to sort of prove that and sort of that take that position. But actually, I think he also generally distrusts alliances. He has a far more transactional worldview. So it's not just NATO. I mean, for the UK as well, the Five Eyes intelligence relationship, the AUKUS treaty that we also have with the Australians, all of these things will be a question mark. And on Taiwan, I think the difficulty is that US intelligence assessments currently assess that the PLA will have a favorable window of opportunity around 2027. So that, as a sort of global flashpoint, will only increase at the time that we might have a second Trump presidency. Ukraine is still ongoing. You know, the war in Gaza shows no sign of abating, and also is regionally expanding to other places in the Red Sea. So this is a time where we need alliance cohesion, not fragmentation.
Yeah, the PLA, of course, the People's Liberation Army, so China's military.
The other thing I wanted to ask you about, Ed, and I don't think it's controversial to say, Donald Trump, the other group Donald Trump doesn't have the highest regard for, are women. Does it mean if he's the next president or he's back in the White House that it's highly unlikely, impossible, that you'll have a woman leading NATO?
I'm not too sure on that. And I think, yes, it's kind of irrelevant for the timescales, because Jens Stoltenberg is due to stand down on the 1st of October after his extension last year. So there's every chance that we'll have a different Secretary General by the time that Trump may or may not come in. He did previously in his administration, I mean, Nikki Haley, who he's now running against, was his UN ambassador. Fiona Hill was also his Russia advisor. So I don't think that's necessarily an issue at the moment. I think the bigger aspect is that Trump in 2016 was able to bring in some senior sort of grown-up people from the defense and security establishment who tried to sort of temper him, and none of those survived the first term. So the chances of similar people going in a Trump 2 presidency is probably not going to be likely, and therefore actually the quality of his advisors around him will be much poorer, meaning that they won't necessarily push back on the things that he says that he wants to do. So the risk is that he actually might be able to do more of what he wants.
After the NATO gathering, you've also got the Munich Security Conference that begins on Friday. Their 2024 report talking about lose-lose dynamics. We know that there'll be many leaders. And as you said, the security sort of global participants in the global and security industry, plus the US Vice President Kamala Harris will be there, meeting Zelensky, meeting Scholz of Germany. I wonder from your perspective how you think about this change that I sort of mentioned at the start of the program, you know, that we are children, I think you are too, of the post-Cold War era of peace, of dwindling defence spending. How radical is the change in your industry and the thinking within the military establishment now?
Yeah, I think it's changing. And I think the really important point is, you know, we must make sure that whatever sort of security arrangements that we're building, you know, are based on the current and potential future requirements. You know, there's elements of this confrontation that does look similar to the Cold War, but it's really important not to regress, but actually look further to the future. And I think the one thing that does need to be more radical, and you mentioned there, is yes, it's fine all of these policymakers getting together in Munich and all sort of sitting together and discussing, but what they really need to be doing is discussing these issues with the wider public. So that level of public outreach, because ultimately the public needs to be appraised of these risks and also understand why their governments are making the decisions they are. And ultimately, if the defence spending is going to have to increase, which it almost certainly will they need a sort of the legitimacy for that? So yeah, it's fine that we're having these not quite closed door conversations, but certainly exclusive conversations. It really needs to be broadened out to wider NATO societies so they understand the risks.
Okay, Ed Arnold, Research Fellow for European Security from Defence and Security Think Tank, RUSI. We thank you for joining us.
I think the point that Ed makes there about the disconnect and the swift change, I mean, I know that the war in Ukraine is now 3 years on, but actually the thread from the war in Ukraine to the wider threat to NATO, potentially from Putin, that has escalated, and the disconnect between that and where populations in Europe might be thinking, I think, is a really significant issue.
Yeah, look, part of the reason there is a cost of living crisis is because of the war in Ukraine. People are preoccupied with that. You talk about this post-Cold War era of peace. There's this allergy to going to war post Iraq and Afghanistan, and the pendulum hasn't swung back the other way. There isn't this appetite to spend more of GDP on defence.
I think it's a conversation we will continue to have, but that's it from us for today. If you like the programme, don't forget to subscribe and give it 5 stars so that other people can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.
This episode was produced by Tiwa Adebayo, and our audio engineer was Marufa Hussain. I'm Lizzie Burden.
And I'm Caroline Hepke. We'll be back with more tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, 3 launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Measure that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.